From Booksmart Studios, this is Lexicon Valley, a podcast about language. I'm John McWhorter, and I want to continue in the vein of the last show. I don't usually do it this way, but it seems almost inevitable that if there was a whole show about the verb come, then certainly we have to say something about, well, three guesses, the verb go, because actually it's just as interesting as come. Coming and going are a big part of any language. They express themselves in many ways. And so let's talk about go. So, for example, talk about come and its past form came and how that's not what it's supposed to be. And then the business with my son is come after a long journey away. Well, you know, with go, if you think about it, the past is wrong, too, because you say went. Clearly, went is not a form of the root go. I go, he goes, and then I went, and she went. That went is actually a whole different verb. Go is a funny thing where two different verbs had a train wreck, and now they occupy the same space. So if you think about it, I wended my way into the forest or something like that. It's that wend verb, which itself is marginal, but that's where the went comes from. And so you stop using the past form of go. That's a weird thing about how English treats go. And it's funny, it's as if English wants it that way, because if you go back to Old English, it's not went, but it's this other weird verb, oud. And so I went is ik oud. So there's the go, and that's in the present. But then in the past, all of a sudden, it's this oud thing that didn't make it past the Battle of Hastings. And you know, that form in Old English sticks around into early Middle English. And so there's this form yod that completely throws you. You're waiting for winter, like winter or something like that. And instead, you get yod. And that's the original irregular form of go. And that comes from this ancient verb that got replaced by what we now know as the rather precious verb wend. And that's where we get went. It's heavy usage that creates kind of ugly little situations like that. Heavy usage means that stuff from the past has a way of holding on. For example, children instead of childs, men instead of mans, mice instead of mouses. Those hold on. They're 12 or 13. I can never remember which. But there used to be a lot more plurals like that in English, a lot more. The ones that held on were things that either now are very commonly talked about, such as children, women, and men, or used to be, such as mice, lice, and geese, and such. They hold on because they're used heavily. Well, with go, you know, you've got different ways of saying go, but they're used a lot, and so things just get kind of messy. If by chance you happen to use the wend one more in the past, well, it holds on that way. And in general, there is, in Europe, an issue with go being taken care of by two completely different verbs. And so with French, for example, I go, je vais, but then we go, nous allons. Clearly, vais and allons are not the same thing. Or in Russian, and so I am going, я иду, but then if I do it in the past, шёл. They're clearly not the same thing. This is a go issue, and it's because go is used so heavily. And you can see it even in languages that are new. So, for example, the Creole language Saramaccan, which I have discussed in a now very previous episode, only came into existence in the late 1600s, and it would have begun as a pidgin, as in not a language, but a makeshift lingo created by slaves in the desperate situation of plantation slavery, where they had to learn the dominant language on the fly. But human beings don't live in pidgins. And if you're going to live a life, then you're going to create the pidgin, and then you're going to expand it into a brand new language. But when you do that, you're not going to all of a sudden create all of these ridiculous endings and irregularities. You don't create that. Languages drift into that sort of thing by accident. But an interesting thing in Saramaccan is that I'm going to say, I walk, miwaka. There you go. Now, I can also say, I am walking. The way you do it is not with some suffix, but you do it with a little word that you put before the verb. So, miwaka, I walk, mitawaka, I am walking, right? Okay. But for go, it's different, only with go. It's the only verb in the language. I go, mi go. I am going is not mitago, it's minango. The reason it's nango is because if you say mitago enough, it might change into minango. That is one of the few irregularities like that. And in Saramaccan, wouldn't you know that it has to be with go. But then you never know. Go can get more complicated, but then chance might have it that a language makes go less complicated, tries to fix the irregularity. And so, for example, in Scottish, went is gad. And so, in other words, goad. That's the way Scottish has it, because really the go went thing is rather absurd. Why is it like that? And it might be that because to an extent, people like order. See, that's the thing about how language goes. On the one hand, people can tolerate massive amounts of disorder in language, because by the time you realize it doesn't make sense, your massively plastic young brain has picked up the habit. But then on the other hand, one also seeks pattern. Those two things are always working against each other. And so you can have kinds of English where you say goad and it's okay, because went never really made any sense. It reminds me of a lesson that Stephen Jay Gould, the paleontologist, taught. I learned so much from him about, one, science, and two, science writing. I shamelessly imitate him and then maybe one and a half other writers in terms of the way I like to write. But Gould made a point in, which one was it? I think it was Wonderful Life, that evolution is about things getting more complicated, but it's also about things getting less complicated, depending on what the evolutionary conditions are, that things get bigger, but then things can also get smaller. And I remember the example that he used was clams, because he was actually a specialist in clams. Imagine being a specialist in clams and, you know, going into the kind of fame that he had by popularizing. And part of that meant not writing too much about the clams, but when he did, somehow he made it interesting. And one of the things that he showed was that clams over time in some places got smaller and less interesting, as opposed to life always climbing into ever greater complexity and culminating, for example, in us who are basically going to just ruin the planet. That's not the only story. And, you know, go is something. We just use it. Frankly, it seems rather dull in itself. It's so short. Go, right. And it's a very basic concept. We go places, okay? Imagine being somebody from another language coming to English and mastering how many ways we use go. You don't think about this, but think about, I went like this. And I'm talking about like moving my elbow in a certain way or something like that. You know, the doctor says, don't go like that if it hurts. You go like this. Or the song, how does the song go? It goes like this. Funny usage of go. I mean, you kind of get that the song is moving, but there are many other ways of saying that, and most languages use them. We say the song goes like this. Notice that in some other language you know, you almost certainly don't use the go verb in that way. Or, okay, now you go in a game. Well, where are you going? It's kind of a stretch of go, but you go. And then, of course, yes, go to the bathroom. You know, I have to go. Well, that's a euphemism, but yet more of this going. Just listen, for example, to this is, I couldn't resist. Stephen Sondheim, it's playing on Broadway right now in a great revival anyway. Merrily, we roll along. And this is the number Franklin Shepard Inc., where Charlie is describing how he and his songwriting partner work. Listen to these uses of go.
I know our audience would love to hear how you two work together.
Sure. He goes. And I go. And soon we're humming along, and that's called writing a song. Then he goes, and I go, and the phone goes, bring, and he goes, mutter, 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 yes, Jerome, mutter, no, Jerome, mutter, 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 that's a lawyer, Jerome, mutter, 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 do it, Jerome, click, sorry, Charlie. So I go. And he goes, and I go, and soon we're tapping away. Sorry, Charlie. Secretary.
Who knew? Not going to get that in the language textbook. I can just imagine the textbook will say, go is used in many idiomatic ways. Listen closely and gradually you'll master the full field of its uses. And then a little smiley face or something. No, it's kind of torture, I'm sure. By the way, if you want a bonus segment on a particular use of the word go, then just go to booksmartstudios.org and click on Lexicon Valley. And the idea is, yes, to give us a little money and you get extra stuff. And that's not the only thing. Wait till the end of the show and I'll remind you what else you get. But if you want the bonus segment, booksmartstudios.org. Click on Lexicon Valley. In any case, there's even more. Go is also used as a negative imperative marker. What does somebody mean when they say, don't go knocking a chair over, don't go getting dirty before your relatives come? You could say, don't get dirty before your relatives come. But if you say, don't go getting dirty before your relatives come, it conveys a certain kind of disapproval. It's a negative imperative marker that has an air of particular disapproval about it. And that's actually a piece of grammar, and you use go. And if you think about it, why go? And of course, it starts with imagining the person going off somewhere where you aren't so that they can commit the transgression and then coming back. But don't go doing blah, 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 blah. So it's just like a little Billy Joel, just the way you are. Notice that he doesn't say, don't change. That wouldn't work. It's don't go changing. Listen here.
Don't go changing to try and please me. You never let me down before. Mm-hmm. Don't imagine you're too familiar. And I don't see you anymore. I would not leave you in times of trouble.
So it's as if English almost knows that it kind of takes things light, and it's like a cat that's nosing into the corner the way they do. They always have to check things out. So, for example, in many languages, there is an explicit negative imperative marker where you don't just say don't, but there's this special word that you use when you're telling someone not to do something. Mandarin would be an example. And so the word for just not is bu. But then the word for don't do something is bie. And so, for example, to say, oh, don't even mention it. Don't mention it. Bie ti. You don't say bu ti. Whatever that would mean, it wouldn't be don't mention it. So English is trying to have more stuff, but it starts with things that feel like slang or idioms. But really, the Martian would think of it as grammar. But to bring it back to come, you know, come is used in that same way as go, as a marker of disapproving attitude. And you have to listen to the dialect carefully to understand how systematic it is. But something like, she comes telling me she's going to be late. So you could say, she told me she's going to be late. That's okay, but the attitude really comes with using come. She comes telling me she's going to be late. And it doesn't necessarily mean that she walked into the room and planted herself before you and did it. That come conveys that you don't approve that she said that. If you don't know what I mean, maybe you'll get a sense of a flavor of it from actually a not that great stylistic song from back in the day, but listen to them using in the chorus this Black English disapproving come.
If you don't wanna leave the surf, just check it out. Don't come telling me lies. On the tears and all these negative vibes. Come telling me lies.
Go also teaches us about how sound change works. It's rather magnificent, sometimes rather random within constraint. But originally in English, one of the things that throws you in Old English is that go is ga. And so how do you get from ga to go? Well, actually, it makes sense. It's kind of like chess. Sound change doesn't do completely insane things. So ga might become ga. Ah, aw, all that is slightly reshaping your mouth. But then once you're at ga, and you've forgotten about ga, ga to go is really very easy. You can even think of ga as a way of saying go with some weird thick accent. But ga, ga, easy. Ga, go, easy. And that means that something that starts as ga might, 1,000 years later, be go. Those sorts of things happen all the time. And it's not just with the go verb. That sound changes throughout the language, depending on where it sits in words. And so the original word for stone, Old English's stone, was stan. That went stan, ston, stone. The original word for bone, well, you can guess. It was bon. Or even think about two. Think about two's spelling. So it looks like two, and at a certain point, it was. It was two. Originally, in Old English, you find that two is twa. The two comes later. So, gago, stan stone, bonbon, twa two. Those things are perfectly normal. And so go demonstrates that. But then remember, in Scotland, God. And so why is it basically God? I mean, slightly different sound change there, but it's still there. It didn't become goad in Scotland. It's God. Well, why is that? Because sound change, there's a randomness about it. So the Jurassic Park scene with the water droplet that Jeff Goldblum puts on Laura Dern's hand, you can't know which way it's going to go. Now, you know that it's not going to flow upward into the air, but in terms of the hand, you can't know exactly where it's going to be different each time. So Scotland and England are not in the same place. And that meant that the language, the English that was originally brought to the island, and of course, even there, we're oversimplifying because there would have been different Englishes, but still, they would have been very close together. The English thing that was brought to the island went in different directions in different places. Now, the ga to go, stan to stone, that's what happened in the dialect or dialects that happened to become standard English, i.e. the English that we're familiar with now. But up in Scotland, it didn't go that way. There were different changes. And so, for example, the word tongue, tongue, you can imagine a Scot or a Northern Brit, that tongue. What is that? Well, for one thing, ga didn't become go in Scotland. But for another thing, think about the words food, good, and blood. Now, I always say that writing is not language. But in this case, think about what they look like on the page and notice that they don't rhyme. Food, good, blood. It's a weird thing. The original situation was food. That sound is supposed to be oo, or really o, but then that changes to oo. So, food. Now, originally it's food, good, blood. But that sound changes. And so, one place that oo goes is uh. And so, food, and then good. Now, food happened to stay where it was, conservative, probably partly because it's used so much. But then good went on. And so, that's why it's good. That's why it's hood, and so on. But then the next place that can go is oo. It's just like ah, aw, oh. And so, food, good, and then blood. But it might not do that. It's all about Laura Dern's hand. And so, it might be that in different English, the furthest anything goes is good. And they like it that way. They think it's good. And so, you don't have tongue. It's not tong, and then tung, and then tongue. Instead, it just stays at tung. But this is what's interesting. You have the way many standard English speakers now in America would say, for example, gone. They'd say gone. You say not raw fish, but raw fish. There isn't a hawk making lazy circles in the sky, but a hawk making lazy circles in the sky. Linguists call this the caught merger. And I don't have it because I am 58 and grew up in the Northeast. A cot is something I hope never to actually have to sleep on. And caught is something I presumably did to a fish. And so caught, caught. But for increasing numbers of Americans, it's caught and caught. You caught a fish. And rah, 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 I'm eating raw fish. The sound aw is disappearing. I used to teach this to students by saying that if you have the caught-caught merger, you probably have remnants of aw. What would you say if a squirrel ran up your leg wanting food and you weren't afraid of rabies? And it used to be that almost all the class would say aw. And so I'd say, okay, that sound, even if you do say raw fish. Nowadays, it's gotten to the point that most of the class says ah, because even the aw is gone from there. But the thing is, that means that you don't say that the squirrel is gone. You say the squirrel is gone. And what that means is that you've taken it back to old English. You never know how these things are going to be. It's all chance. It's like chinchillas in a cage. I once knew a guy whose attempts at dating a friend of mine failed because he thought that it was cool that he had chinchillas as pets. And they're cute, but he had like 9 of them, and they're all in the cage, always just kind of moving around and shitting, and that's just all they did. Well, vowels are like chinchillas. Go is also something where, because it attracts irregularity, that's exactly where certain periwigged people are going to start telling you that you're doing it wrong. For example, he had went. I hear it all the time. It almost feels right. And that's because, and I don't usually bring up previous shows until they're pretty far in the past, but that show I did not too long ago where I described how this is where English wants to go. Very commonly, the past tense form is being used as the past participle form. And there is a kind of rule. If the past participle has the un ending, which it often does, and so take, took, taken. English doesn't like those, and it's trying to get rid of them, and so the past tense form is taken in. So you got took, that kind of thing. You got bit instead of you got bitten. But then, if it isn't an un form, and it's just something different where there's a vowel change, like, for example, sink, sank, sunk, well, then you take the past participle and you replace the past form. And so that's why now it's practically standard to say the ship sunk. It's everywhere. It's now, you know, informal news sources. Sank is dying. Now, there's a little wiggle room, though, especially with see, go, and do, because they have un forms like taken, but you don't quite process it. And so there is seen, and there is gone, and there is done. Now, those are typically seen, going, and doing, but we don't necessarily think of them that way. Often we treat them like sink, sank, sunk. We don't process the n, and so we take the participle because that's the way English wants to go. And so, looks like he gone and done it, that sort of thing. But there's a reason why, for example, someone like me, and I'm a standard speaker, but I said, you know, well, he had went, and then I thought to myself, there I am doing it, because I speak modern American English, and that's where the change is trying to go, despite the fact that we have a sense that things are supposed to freeze because of what writing does to how we perceive language. Or there's another one. My mother, who had a doctorate and was a college professor, actually was not extremely prescriptive about language. Goodness, she was prescriptive about everything else. But about language, she wasn't a big grammar peeve person, except about one thing, and she would always kind of get on me about it, which is that you're supposed to talk about going from the perspective of your own body. So if you're on the phone with somebody and you're making plans, you're not supposed to say, I'll come to you. You're supposed to say, I'll go to you, because your experience will be going, not the experience of the person on the other end of the line who will experience you as coming. And I'm sure some of you have been told that, and there's a part of me that always thinks of it, but no, I'm sorry, and whoever else thinks that, that's very tidy. But does anybody really have a problem with, for example, somebody calls and somebody else in the house picks up the phone and they say, it's for you, and you say, I'm coming, as you go to the phone? Does anybody really have a problem with that? I'm coming, and you're putting yourself into the mind of the person who is waiting for you to take the phone from their hand. Notice I'm making this a scene from when people are sitting there using dial phones. Things have changed, but you take my point. And of course, it's because I learned this rule when there were still dial phones. Have you touched a rotary phone lately, if you're of a certain age? It feels really good. I mean, modern phones, you know, God bless them in many ways, but the rotary phone doing the dial and then putting that Bakelite plastic thing up to your ear, there is a comfort there that we will never have with these little handheld devices. In any case, the thing is, you say, I'm coming. Is the idea that French and Russian get it right? Because with French, what you would say as you're running to the phone is, j'y vais. And so you're going. I'm going there. Okay. Or in Russian, you say, you do. I'm going. You don't say, I'm coming. But from English, that seems a little peculiar. Do we really want to do it that way? You know, one more sidebar, actually. There's idu, and then my sweetie says that they also say now, like just right now. So much of language is about beyond grammar. You can know the grammar perfectly. You can know 5,000 words, but there is a large extent. It's not a small extent. It's not marginal. It's a large extent to which you have to know, just from experiencing it, from watching it, what words and expressions and grammar are applied to particular situations. And so I once heard her on the phone talking to a Russian friend, and she said, smiling, «Всё в порядке», that meant, is everything okay? Now, I could make up how to say, is everything okay, and it would translate as something like, is all good, or how is your situation? And, you know, a Russian person would understand and despise me. But I noticed then, the way you say, is everything okay, is «Всё в порядке», is all in pattern. You just have to know «Всё в порядке». In any case, this rule, this idea that I'm supposed to say, I'm going when somebody's calling me to the phone, is that we tend to forget how much of language is not only about arbitrariness of expressions, but also that we're in each other's heads. And so, I'll come to you is putting yourself into the other person's head. I will create the situation where I am coming to you, which is what you want. It's the same thing as we're totally getting tickets. When you say we're totally getting tickets, you don't mean we're getting tickets in a total fashion. What you mean by the totally is other people may think we're not or that we shouldn't, but we're going to, and this is something that we both know. That's what, of all things, totally has come to mean. Chaucer would have no blessed idea why we were using it that way. Shakespeare would, you know, have an extra drink. But that's what it means. Or if you say, well, I have a horse. What do you mean by well? You don't mean hole in the ground with water in it, I have a horse. Nor do you mean in a good fashion, I have a horse. Well, I have a horse is I acknowledge what you're saying and something that's relevant to what you're saying is, and you might want to know this, I have a horse. I'm coming is the same thing. So I think we should all get over that. And by the way, the vowels and the chinchillas, some people learn musically, or I hope. And so I want to give you my sense of those chinchillas in music. This is the overture to a justifiably forgotten musical of 1953 called By the Beautiful Sea. We don't even need to talk about it, but it had a good overture. And part of what was good about the overture is that during the fanfare, there's this neat thing that the orchestrator did with strings that to me sounds exactly like chinchillas and vowels. I'm going to play it for you. So listen to this. This is the overture of By the Beautiful Sea. Hear that? That's chinchillas. Anyway, one last thing about Go. You often hear from people, even linguists and anthropologists, or at least I have, Go is a hotbed for this, a certain perspective that from the way people express going, you can know what they're like as a culture. And I'm not going to go on one of my anti-Whorfian rants here, except I am, because really, you just have to be careful about that. Languages get much more elaborate about go than having just one irregular verb. And so Russian, again, you have different forms, completely different stems. If you are just going open-endedly, as opposed to whether you went and came back. Я шел, I just went. Я ходил, I went and I also came back. And then that changes if you're in a vehicle. So what I'm talking about is like feet. But then if you're in, you're rolling along, then I either ехал or if I went and came back, I ездил. These are completely different verbs and this just goes on and on. And so you may think, well, there's something about going in Russianness, but have you ever thought of Russians as a going people? Compared to, you know, say the British and the French. I mean, the British and the French certainly seem to have gone places. It's just, you don't say, like, oh, there's Sergei. He's always afoot. It just doesn't work. And my favorite example of how going can be insane, and yet it has nothing to do with the people, is the Ket. Ket is a language that is rapidly dying right now, which is too bad for many reasons, one of which is that it really is, I think by any metric, one of the most grammatically complex on the planet. The complexity and irregularity of Ket is astounding. It was rarely learned by outsiders, and so it was left to be just the way language can get if nobody touches it, miraculously still acquirable by kids who don't have anything else to do and can't process how absurd the language is. And I mean absurd in a magnificent way. But with Ket, going is all over the place, just learning how to say go. So roughly, I imagine if you asked a cat, I don't think I'll ever meet one, but how would you say go? And never mind that it isn't just one word, that it's a suffix hanging on the end of all this other stuff, but it's roughly tn. It's a kind of weird word for go from our perspective because there's no vowel, but tn, that's go. And so you're thinking, well, okay, tun. But really, you only use tun in some cases. If you say something like, for example, I go to the river. This, I go to the river. And it's a special nuance here. This is just for one thing. If I go to the river and stay there. So remember, in Russian, it's that you have to have a form for if you went and came back. There must be something. This is in Siberia, so there must be something about this territory where you have to specify whether you're going back or something. But I go to the river, and if I'm going to the river and I'm going to stay there, then you don't use tun at all. Instead, the way you say I go to the river and stay is didadak. And notice what I did at the end. Not didadak, didadak. And what I did was a uvular stop. You indicate that with a Q. It's fun to do it. In any case, I go to the river and stay. Di-da-da. All right? There's no tun. It's the da. But then if you say we go to the river and stay, then how you say it is dik-da-dankut. Now, not only is there no tun, but there's no da. Because instead, you have to use this kut. And so, dik-da-dankut. And that's we go to the river and stay. Very important. Now, of course, if I'm in the river, like this is about me going to the river. If I'm in the river and I go upriver, and also this is only about if I do it and stay. If I go upriver and I stay there, it's certainly not tun, and it's not dik-da-da. Instead, it's deskabis. What happened? If I go upriver, like up to my waist in it, with leeches biting all over me, and for some reason, despite that, I stay wherever I'm going. Apparently, it's a miserable place. The Ket basically live in a swamp. They're not going anywhere. But if I'm in the river, and I'm leeched, and I'm looking for a sturgeon or something, and I stay, then it's not di-da-da, but it's deskabis. What happened? You can imagine what the rest of this is like. It took people studying Ket eons to even figure this out. I think they finally have, but 20 years ago, they hadn't. So that's how crazy Go can be, and yet they live in a smallish area, swampy, nobody wants to go in there. The Ket life is not all about going. If you're going to go in Ket world, then you go somewhere else and you stay. People tend to leave the Ket territory under modern conditions. And so a language can be all about Go, even if the people themselves would not think of themselves as exactly the most traveling folk at all. It's just that Go is so often, whatever the cultural conditions surrounding it, seriously fucked up. And if you'd like to leave a comment or subscribe, please visit booksmartstudios.org. Our producer is, as always, Mike Vola. Go to booksmartstudios@gmail.com to leave questions, which I will answer two or sometimes three at a time. It's lots of fun answering the questions. One never knows what people are going to ask. It keeps me on my toes. You also get that with the bonus. You can send us questions. Our theme music was created by Harvest Creative Services, and I am, as always, John McWhorter.